very quickly. My name is Rich McGraw, and I'm just delighted to be here. This is the first time I've ever attended a Sabre convention, and I have to say, you might live to regret that, but okay. I'm just amazed and honored. I mean, I really appreciate the opportunity. I want to thank the organization, the membership. The depth and the range of your baseball knowledge, the enthusiasm for your subject is both inspiring and extremely intimidating. I would also like to thank Steve Treader. When we realized we were doing fairly similar subjects, I got a hold of him, and he was very, very generous in terms of sharing his information. It's just a damn shame I have to follow that quality presentation, but we're trying not to overlap. So I guess in a sense, I'm the prequel to the prequel. If he's 491, I'm 490, because my interest is in culture and society and the broader context that make all of this stuff possible. So, without further ado, on September 3rd, 1945, the day after the formal Japanese surrender, 50,000 American servicemen of all ranks crowded into the stands of what had once been Stadion der Hitlerjugend, the Hitler Youth Stadium, but was now officially Soldiers Field in Nuremberg, Germany, to watch the opening game of the European Theater of Operations, the ETO World Series. Here both symbol and prophecy mixed with equal import. A baseball game played on the very site of the Nuremberg rally spoke powerfully to the triumph of Allied arms, the victory of democracy over fascism. "We had a conqueror's frame of mind," recalled William Ukes, then a PFC radioman from Missouri, who attended the game. "The Germans had surrendered unconditionally, and this proved it." But to Ukes and his comrades, an afternoon in the bleachers under a late summer sun not only affirmed the war's verdict, but anticipated the immediate future, the return home, and the resumption of normalcy in a post-war world. Yet what transpired down on the field during those five games augured of something distinctly different. The series matched heavily favored champions of George Patton's Third Army, the 71st Division Red Circlers, so named for their distinctive shoulder patches, against a team based in France, the decidedly less euphonious Overseas Invasion Service Expedition All-Stars, shortened by headline writers to COMZ, and I thank them for that. Patton's team included the Cardinals' Harry Walker and several former major and minor leaguers, together with Cincinnati's Jules the Whip Blackwell, who coasted in the opener to an easy 9-2 win. But as they came to their last at-bat in Game 2, the Red Circlers trailed 2-1, having amassed only four weak singles against the opposing starter Leon Day, late of the Newark Eagles, who closed out the win when he induced Walker's weak fly ball to outfielder Willard Home Run Brown, the former cleanup hitter with the Kansas City Monarchs and briefly future St. Louis Brown. Three games later, in a deciding fifth game, Day's legs and Brown's bat made the difference. In the seventh inning, Day entered the game as a pinch runner on first base, stole second, third, scored the tying run on a sacrifice fly. Two innings later, Brown's double off Blackwell drove home the clinching run for an upset victory. It's a portent, obviously. The very same mix of relief, anticipation, and enthusiasm pervading the bleachers at Soldiers Field swept the country with the approach of opening day 1946. "In the years immediately following World War II," writes David Haverstam, "professional baseball mesmerized the American people as it never had before and never would again. Perhaps more than anything else," he continues, "the game turned back time, sustained the illusion vital to millions of Americans yearning to return to life as it had been before Pearl Harbor. This is what we've been waiting for," enthused a Cleveland headline announcing Bob Feller's return from the Navy in August 1945, and those headlines are found all across the country as everybody came back. Small wonder, then, that editors gushed and turnstiles clicked at record pace that opening day as April regained its preeminence in the season of hope. With the return of many Diamond Stars from military service during the past year, the majors, the 1946 opening day lineups not only took on a new luster, the Sporting News affirmed, but also resembled more closely the first day inaugurals of 1941, the last campaign, the last pre-war campaign, than did any of the previous three inaugurals. The exuberance spoke simultaneously of renewal and celebration. Following the war, the crowds embodied the national mood during what journalist Red Smith would remember as, quote, "the sporting scene's liveliest years of all." Professional sport, he observed, had barely survived the hard years of the war, baseball especially, with ranks so thin that it existed in 1945 on a level that made a one-armed outfielder a star. Peace revived those games' fortunes. When the war ended, he recalled, people had begun to save money they couldn't spend on steaks and shoes for quite a while, so they were more than willing to spend it on sports. Yet in addition to sheer amusement or sublimation of deferred desire, sports generally, baseball especially, affirmed early post-war American self-perceptions. In a very real sense, their sporting enthusiasms not only reflected but extended the triumph of their wartime experience. At least one historian, William L. O'Neill, attributes battlefield success in part to the sporting backgrounds of American GIs. Similarly, combat journalists explained the war to home front Americans through a series of sporting metaphors and analogies. The games were thus, at least in part, celebration of the nation itself in triumphant, youthful vigor, manifested by active bodies displayed on playing fields in graceful, purposeful action. The easy transition from the playing field to the battlefield and back also served to mask the war's sterner truths and the world's continuing agony. I have a longer section in here, the way the brush fires kept smoldering all across war-ravaged Europe and Asia. We're talking about the collapse of civil institutions in much of Western Europe, raging civil wars across Asia and in Central or in Eastern America, or Eastern Europe, rather, the civil war in China, and you can go on and on and on, which is to say a war ravaged or left ravaged by the world everywhere, that is, except here. I think we're all familiar with the economic miracle and the way the Americans just catapulted to global preeminence as a consequence of the war. No society in history had accrued such power so fast, a fact both dazzling and unsettling. In a sense, obviously, all of this had been made possible by the loss of some 420,000 U.S. servicemen, two of whom had major league experience, albeit both of them extremely briefly. Captain Elmer Gedeon was killed on April 20th, 1944, when his bomber was struck by an aircraft fire and crashed in France. 11 months later, on Iwo Jima, Japanese sniper killed Marine Lieutenant Harry O'Neill. A local Derby boy who had gotten into one game for Connie Max A's, he was a catcher, and who never got to bat. Again, the rise to global preeminence is both remarkable in terms of this surge of American power, but by the way that early post-war moment was accompanied by a profound undercurrent of nervousness. At home, demobilization paralyzed the transportation system, while a housing shortage critical throughout the war only worsened. Such basic consumer commodities as sugar, bread, toilet paper, and meat remained scarce while black markets thrived. Quickening inflation sapped purchase power and deepened anxieties over the return of depression conditions. Enlarged by the war, emboldened by the peace, organized labor unleashed an unprecedented wave of strikes in 1946, more than 2,000 of them, crippling such key industries as steel, coal, railroads, and automobile assemblies. Meanwhile, the wartime alliance with the Soviets, never more than a marriage of convenience, had already collapsed. Fear of the communists now crept fog-like across the land, permeating homes and schools and the halls of Congress, in a world radically altered by the terrible power of the atomic bomb. The war might have ended, but the peace, tentative at best, remained elusive. Organized baseball showed a similar inability to reclaim its presumed pre-war familiarity. Undeniably, the game had limped through the season since Pearl Harbor, yet the promise of expanded profits notwithstanding, the return of peace created for the men who managed baseball a nearly insoluble set of problems. Like the larger culture, many were rooted in the war, though none vexed owners or animated their discussions more than the question of what to do with players returning from the service. The haggling began at least as early as February 1944 and continued beyond opening day 1946, by which time the issue had only grown more complex. In a sense, it came down to a couple of basic issues. First, the overriding issue was federal law, an issue that arose from the stipulation of the Selective Service Law of 1940, specifically Section 8B, which required private employers to restore returning servicemen to their former positions at the same level, at the same or better pay, with all the seniority. Obviously, from the owner's perspective, two questions arose immediately: roster spots and invariably salaries. The wartime manpower drain had forced the suspension of several minor league circuits for the duration. But now the blow fell unevenly and especially hard on lower B, C, and D leagues, forcing parent clubs to assign contracts wholesale to affiliates in higher classifications. See the rub. Additionally, owners feared the mass release of players, perhaps in mid-season, making it all but impossible to comply with selective service stipulations and league rules governing roster size. Moreover, as Calvin Griffith lamented and Branch Rickey affirmed, the federal mandate guaranteed pre-war salaries of such older players as Hank Greenberg, their continuous example, who had joined the service relatively late in their careers and whose skills almost certainly had degraded during the war. Rickey then outlined the horns of the owner's dilemma. And there's the quote. I don't need to read it for you, but if anyone has ever wondered what a Branch Rickey quote would look like, short of its dependent clauses and interjections and qualifying phrases, wonder no more. Had we had the whole text, we'd be five or six slides down the road by now. Basically, you see the horns of the dilemma. How do we maximize profits and minimize public criticism for maximizing profits at returning soldiers' expense? It gets worse. In the afternoon session, the lawyers went to work. I've got, Judge Landis, everybody knows, Leo Bondi of the New York Giants, neither one of whom would survive 1944, but both of whom asked the key questions. As their afternoon session began, Judge Landis basically says the obvious. Look, if a player in B, C, or D levels had joined the service, and then the parent team had kicked him up to a higher level, A, double A ball, but had not issued him a contract in 1943 or 4 or 5, the years he was gone, what's his legal status? Bondi understood it pretty clearly and said, wait a minute, we're bound to give the guy a job. And the next guy, Joseph Hosteller of the Indians, sort of ices the cake by saying, but you know what? How do we answer the guy when he comes back and tells us that, look, the wartime circumstances, you didn't give me a contract, nobody could honor the reserve rule, I'm a free agent. At which point Sam Braden essentially fainted and spent the rest of the afternoon returning over and over and over again to the specter of mass free agency. It was a chilling question and a kind of an argument that they would return to, a question they would return to, struggling to resolve really for the next couple of years. And every time they got to it, as Warren Giles Riley observed in December of 1945, every time we talk about this subject, we make it easier for us and harder for them to make the transition, and there's going to be trouble. He was right. Here are the national defense regulations. I really don't think we need to go all the way through them. Basically, give the guy back his job, pay him what he's worth. He's got a specific time trial. In other words, when being reinstated into the service, he's got 15 playing days in regular season, 30 training days for you to make a decision to dispense with or determine where the conflict's going or where the contract's going, and you cannot demote him lower than one league. So obviously, it's the major league owners. If we send them down, then we're going to make the minor league owners pay, and the minor league owners are a little concerned about that. All right. As Giles says, we're making it easier for us, harder for them. There's bound to be trouble, and it was almost immediate in arriving. It's a well-documented conversation. It took place on a railroad train. As both of these guys, former New Englanders and recently mustered out Navy veterans, got together out in California, Tony Lupien had come back from the war as a Navy lieutenant, only to find out that his contract, held by the Philadelphia Phillies, had been sold to the Hollywood Stars. He had a grievance, which he began to file, started to write letters, which never got answered, never got returned. Frankly, I'm from Philadelphia, and I know how awful those Phillies were. He should have been happy to have been, but okay, we'll go with that. He appealed all the way to the commissioner's office, sent him a registered letter. It came back unopened. But then the Hollywood Stars says, you know, okay, we're going to match the Phillies' salary, and okay, fine, I'm going to get the wife and we'll go west. But then on the train, he bumps into Al Nemiak, who is an older guy. He's about to turn 35. He had been voted the best defensive player in the Pacific Coast League, 1941. And then right after Pearl Harbor, he too had joined the Navy. In the conversation, Nemec confessed to Lupien his fear that his team, the Seattle Rainiers, were going to release him as a consequence of his age. When he did, Lupien said, well, you know what, you have these rights, exercise them. If they do that, you do this. Well, they did that, and he did this, which was to file federal suit, ultimately decided on June 21st, 1946, by federal district judge Lloyd F. Black. It's a fascinating case if you've got any interest in this at all, but we'll boil it down as quickly as we possibly can. It comes down to essentially three points. One, says the judge, Nemec is entitled to his job. Obviously, it's federal law. These guys are protected for a year, and you've released him without proper trial. Now, again, in trial, the Rainier's attorney had argued, "Oh, well, we gave him a fair shake." But then the judge got involved in the agate type and said, "No, I looked it up. He played in five games. You won three of them. He only made one error. Nobody else made more." It's the fewest number of errors that anybody has made on that team at that position. Two, that contract you owners write could not be more unfair and imbalanced generally. It's all the advantages to you, none of the advantages to them. And most importantly, the language is so confusing and so obscure, specifically with rights entitled to returning veterans under the Selective Service Act, that this thing obviously is on very, very, very shaky legal foundations, even to the extent where he warns them below here that, yeah, I know what the court said in 1922, but there is plenty of basis here to sort of revisit the subject of whether or not National Professional Baseball is of an interstate character. Then he did the thing, having caught Major League Baseball with the hand in the cookie jar, then he did the thing... Can't read from here. Five. Oh, well, that's awful. Usually I've got captive audiences here. You're hearing those lectures over. That's all. No. In a sense, what the judge had said, I mean, he said, I've read words like opinion and waiver, or option and waiver, in your contracts, and that was, quote, rather reminiscent of chattel. Then he took him to task. We've heard that word before. Then he scolded him. He did exactly what Branch Rickey feared. He's going to catch us, you know, trying to maximize profit at veterans' expense, and then he's going to expose us to public criticism, which he did. Essentially, he said in very wry language, he said, you've told me several times in my courtroom that baseball is the national game and stands for something much more than just entertainment, and I believe that, which is why you have so much of a higher responsibility to care for returning veterans. After all, they did their job. And if they hadn't have done their job, you wouldn't be doing your job, period. Well, let me very quickly then tell the rest. And since my interest, obviously, it's race and the war, and obviously the way that Robinson's arrival conditions labor. So that visually and chronologically, it's the end of the race war in the Pacific, the aftermath of the race war in Europe, Hitler's campaign against the Jews, and the obvious man on the left here, who had experience with the so-called Double V campaign, the war in African American communities, not just against the tyrant abroad, Adolf Hitler, but the tyrant at home, Jim Crow. So it makes perfect sense in this regard, I think. And then the obvious implication here, Branch Rickey is viewed here in the act of breaking the gentleman's agreement, which was always as much about labor as it was race. Yes, players may strain against the reserve rule as a labor thing, but as race, it certified whiteness and included players in a rhetoric, if not a reality, of honorable manhood. It even prescribed owners from hiring African-American scabs in the case of a player's strike. But with the war ended and the gentleman's agreement rescinded, players felt especially vulnerable in a labor market now no longer restricted artificially by race and now glutted by wartime consequence. Given the numbers involved and the degree of labor insecurity, small wonder that some players succumbed to the dazzling offers of Jorge Pascal and his brothers, while others lent a sympathetic ear to Robert Murphy, whose fledgling American Baseball Guild had narrowly lost a strike vote taken in the Pittsburgh clubhouse earlier that month. Meanwhile, out in California, Tony Lupien had already begun his attempt to organize a Pacific Coast League Players Union. This is labor upheaval, and it mirrors what the circumstances of 1946 show. The upshot, I think we all know, the June tumult produced an immediate reaction from the men who managed organized baseball. That is the so-called McPhail Committee, spearheaded by the mercurial man himself, whose efforts to extract baseball from its several predicaments that summer aligned it with a sweeping backlash against New Deal liberalism and organized labor immediately following the war. Orchestrated in part by the National Association of Manufacturers, the Chamber of Commerce, the movement sought to regain confidences eroded by years of depression and war among civic groups, community associations, church congregations, private consumers, by identifying New Deal and labor unions with collectivism, state planning, and communism. Instead, business groups and individual corporations, organized baseball among them, promoted themselves as the guardians of free enterprise, individualism, and common cause with workers on a mutually beneficial exchange. What social scientists have since labeled the embourgeoisement of workers, writes historian Elizabeth Cohen, also implied a trade-off, rewards of material prosperity and social integration in return for ceding shop floor control and company governance to management, and for accepting private corporate welfare, such as pension plans and health and insurance, in place of expanded, more socially democratic welfare state, which is exactly what the McPhail plan did. In other ways, too, baseball joined an emerging conservative critique of post-war American society, noteworthy for its simultaneous opposition to federal regulatory authority, to organized labor, and the nascent civil rights movement. Revisions to the basic contract effectively preserved the reserve rule, albeit in slightly altered form, and established a de facto company union through modest salary increases and a pension plan, an increasingly popular tactic among private sector owners and managers determined to undermine attachments to the New Deal, to federal wartime regulations, and to labor unions. Befitting this transitional moment, fearing federal scrutiny, the McPhail Report criticized organized baseball's archaic administrative structure, demanded its modernization, even as it steadfastly opposed integrated baseball. Thus, the essential relationship between labor and race stalks the 1946 season, rendering normalcy in any pre-war sense of the term little more than sheer illusion. The war had changed so much, so fast, its impact clearly visible even on that much ballyhooed opening day, when sitting in his box seat in Cincinnati, awaiting the start of the Cubs-Reds game, the new commissioner assured reporters of his intention to ban players who would jump to the Mexican League. And then just two days later, in his spectacular debut with the Montreal Royals, Jack Robinson shattered that illusion, the notion of pre-war, a return to 1941 in America as it was before the war, shattered that illusion forever, for baseball, like America, could not be the same. And we thank you. None of this will be on the exam. But...
I'm not sure if you can judge that or not, but it almost sounded like you're getting close to the possibility of opening up free agency. Can you explain why that didn't actually go that way?
Yeah, because the owners feared it so clearly. And I would say this as well. The Nemiak case is really, really fascinating in this regard, and I think it gets to the point you're interested in. Because what the Sporting News broadcast in the immediate aftermath of the verdict is, guess what? He's not an isolated case. There are like 146 major league players who fit that, and their quotes, what an innumerable number of minor league players. So the whole thing, obviously, is to make sure that these guys get signed immediately. Otherwise, we're talking about signing bonuses, we're talking about extra costs, we're talking about salary escalation. It's a major, 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 major headache that these guys never quit talking about, at least so far as they get together the pre-war planning commission and all of the winter league meetings from that point forward, the full 2 years. Every time the league sit down, and that's the focus. How do we keep these guys on the farm? And that obviously is the issue from a laboring perspective. That's, you know, on the one hand, Jorge Pascal in the Mexican League is saying, like, I'm going to corner the Latin American market. What some of the owners, particularly in Philadelphia and in Washington in the American League, used to make ends meet through the war years. You know, you went south and got cheap labor. And then the other issue is, as what the attorneys had always said when it came to Robert Murphy, he's the internal threat. So we've got Pascal in Mexico and Murphy trying to organize. Is that, you know what, had he only talked to Tony Lupien, Robert Murphy, and begun to organize at the minor league level, that's the future labor stream. Get those guys organized, and then you have enormous headaches. So from Larry McPhail's perspective, the whole thing ends happily. Because essentially, in this sort of expanded sort of corporate ethos of private philanthropy, and particularly the pension plans, which Marty Marion, I think folks in here know the St. Louis shortstop, masterminded with Rip Sewell on his way to the All-Star game where Sewell threw the Ephus pitch to Williams, and away we go. I don't want to take too much of your time. It's a big question, though. It's an excellent answer. Or an excellent question, rather. It's not an excellent answer. But it's the best one I heard.
It wasn't just baseball, but lots of industries and coastal areas were hit by this very
carefully
introducing policies that were
really
progressive for the
time. Oh, yeah. To be sure. And I mean, obviously, that's where Ronald Reagan gets to start to work for General Electric, is exactly in that fashion. Yeah. I think we're good. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me.